Well, hello everyone, and welcome to this part of the weekly teaching where we're looking at the spiritual seasons of the year. As we have been journeying through the Torah portions, we've been tracking the development process throughout the year. It is the story of salvation. Development is salvation, really. Our main handle for the year so far has been human development. Spring is a time for rebirth. Shavuot in the late spring, marks a point of adolescence. The fall marks a point of adulthood and marriage. We see that marriage consummation playing out throughout the seventh month in the appointed times of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. Marriage is a kind of new beginning in the year, a second beginning point. God accomplishes the finalizing of the marriage through his son, Yeshua, the Messiah, who is our groom. It is Yeshua who we are raising up as king at Rosh Hashanah, and it is Yeshua who eventually is born among us at Sukkot, becoming our groom. We marry the king. And so Yeshua has a special leadership role in this dark half of the year, the groom walking alongside us in a special but hidden way throughout the long, dark winter, hidden in as much as Yeshua takes on a human form, and even a very humble human form, looking just like one of us. So in contrast to Yeshua's leadership in this way in the fall, we see in the spring, a special leading of God as the Father, the God who shows himself to be big and powerful, the Father who rescues by bringing forth from the womb, the Father who protects and provides. In the summer, we see an emphasis on the leadership of the Holy Spirit, right? We have that whole scene in Acts 2 at Shavuot of the giving of the Spirit, right? And he guides us into the truth of how to walk in God's ways and brings conviction that leads to repentance, teshuva. So, which is, of course, happening in the latter part of the summer. So, again, we find a special leadership of the Father. Over here, we have the Father in the spring. We have the Spirit in the early summer, in the late spring. And we have Yeshua as our groom over here in the fall. And I suspect that what marks the deep winter period, which we're headed into now, which we're in now, is again another leadership time of the Spirit. The Spirit brought forward with the purpose of enabling Yeshua to dwell in our hearts through faith, which is a kind of second and more mature work of the Spirit. So I think the way it's working is Father and Spirit and Son and Spirit. The Spirit is a kind of bridge role. So let me note here by way of quick connection to Joshua that Joshua ends up settling and retiring right in the heart of Israel, in the territory of Ephraim. This is a picture of the end in which Yeshua dwells in the heart through faith. And this is facilitated by the Spirit, as we are told in Ephesians 3. So maybe we can explore these ideas further sometime. But my point here for today is just to say that we have a progression of different faces of God coming forward at different points in our development process and different points in the year as he leads us to grow. As we are being saved, God puts on different faces to lead us. So to be clear, all of these faces of God are always present at all stages of our development. And God is indivisible. He cannot be divided into separate pieces. God is one, period. And yet, he has chosen to show himself to us in this fractured world through different faces. And we relate to him in differing ways through these various aspects of God's character. God is not changing as we grow, but he's presenting different faces to us that we can relate to easily at each stage, right? A little child is going to be able to relate to the face of God the Father, right? And so we need to relate to God in a complex and layered way. And God presents himself to us in such a way that we can easily do that in our development process. So getting back to our review now, another idea we have spent some time with is the role of the New Covenant, particularly starting in the seventh month, the Torah written in the gut and heart, the beginning of an inner flame, an inner passion that is a great source of strength for us moving forward and is connected also with the opening of our eyes to see God in the hidden places. So our discussions so far have brought us through one moed, the man-made moed of Hanukkah, where we emphasize the completion of an inner work and our light beginning to shine on the outside, the movement to a more outward focus. And last time we zoomed in on a specific turning point moment in both the year and in the Torah, the end of Parsha Miketz and the beginning of Parsha Vayigash, when Judah draws near to Joseph and lowers himself down in service to Joseph for the sake of his elderly father. This is the point where Joseph, who is designed to give, finishes passing along to Judah this great inner spiritual growth that has been developing in this special family. And Judah is the key to actualizing that growth in the physical world. So let's turn now to the two Torah portions. We're going to look at both Vayechi, which is the last portion in the book of Genesis, and Shemot, which is the first in the book of Shemot, or Exodus. So these are two momentous portions. The final portion of the first book of the Torah is, that's a big deal, to be the last portion of the first book of the Torah. Vayechi contains Jacob's blessing and adoption of Ephraim and Manasseh, his blessings of all the tribes, and the deaths of two of the most important figures in the Torah, both Jacob and Joseph. I mean, so much space in the Torah is given to these two characters, and here they're both dying in portion Vayechi. It is Joseph's death that actually ends the book of Genesis. Now, Shemot starts the pivotal story of the Exodus from Egypt, the redemption story, right? Shemot begins with the enslavement of Israel in Egypt and Pharaoh's attempts to kill Jewish babies and reduce the size of Israel. Moses is born and raised in Pharaoh's home, but ends up fleeing to the desert, where he eventually has an encounter with God, with the God of the universe, who appears to him as a bush that burns but doesn't burn up. After some arguing back and forth, Moses returns to Egypt to deliver the people in obedience to God. The initial results, however, are not so great, as Pharaoh is made angry by the request to simply take the people and go worship, and he greatly increases the workload of the people, right? He says, you don't get straw anymore. You have to go find that yourself, but your quota is the same for bricks. And so it's a big mess at the end of Shemot. But before we delve into these two portions, let's talk about the new month that we've entered, the month of Tevet. The word Tevet is thought to mean in the original Babylonian, Akkadian, I think, language, it means something like to submerge, which seems to me, you know, in my way of looking, my way of seeing, of course, we're talking about the rains at this time, but also it seems to me a description of being in the body, being in, we're submerged, our spirit is submerged in a body, and we are submerged in this physical world. So that's kind of what our, you know, what what it's like for the spirit to be up there in the, you know, I say up there, but to be in the spiritual realm, and then to have to come into this place is like, you're drowning here in all this material stuff. It's a very confining body. So adding to this idea of submerging in the body or in the physical realm, the Hebrew letters evoke another related idea to the month, as the first two letters in Tevet spell the word Tov, which means good. So putting these two definitions together, the one that comes out of the Akkadian, the Babylonian, the one that, you know, it's represented with Hebrew letters, we draw out the idea of the goodness of being submerged in the body. Okay, let me say that again. The goodness of being submerged in the body. So let's talk about that idea for a minute. When the rabbis talk about this month of Tevet, they often end up speaking about how it's a time to appreciate and enjoy the body and all its different parts. In the month of Tevet, we are given a special ability to recognize the value of the various parts of the body, how they each express a facet of God's mind, how they fit together, how they complement each other. Now, we can't unsee that which we have already seen, which is not kosher in the world around us. That's not what we're trying to do now. We're not trying to close our eyes, right, and only see the good. Rather, we're adding in another perspective to go with the negative side. We're adding in the positive side. So this is a time to see the good in everything around us, while not ignoring what is still on the path to correction. So we can say it like this. It comes natural for us to see with the left eye, right? The critical eye. And the eye that sees how something or someone is falling short of the mark. The eye that sees mostly the flesh, mostly the outside. Right? Where it's easy for us to see the outside. It's what we see, right? So seeing the flesh is absolutely natural for us. In the month of Tevet, though, we are given a special ability to add to the left eye the right eye. Okay, the eye that looks deeper into that person in front of us to see the spark of God in him or her. It's about bringing balance to our vision. And it can entirely change the world that you live in. Because in many ways, we inhabit the world that we choose to see. Make sure that you can always see what is good. You'll be a much happier person. So one area of focus I hear the rabbis talking about specifically regarding the month of Tevet is how we need to actively appreciate all the different voices within the body of Israel, opinions and debates and unique perspectives that have stretched over the centuries and even millennia, even seemingly opposite voices like Hillel and Shammai. One of the things the modern Orthodox rabbis love to do is to take two opposite ideas from history and show how they are both actually right. So sage A says such and such, and two centuries later, sage B says the opposite. And now comes along a modern rabbi in the 21st century who says, let me explain how both of these views can be right at the same time. They love doing this. And I think this generation of rabbis in particular has a special mandate to do just this type of review of the long and beautiful conversation, bringing a kind of echad to the different perspectives. They are peacemakers. And this is because we are indeed drawing near to the end of days and the coming of the Messiah. At the end, we find the word echad, right? At the end, we find the word echad. And this kind of re-seeing of the history of the historical conversation in our days is an expression of the energy of Echad. So this is a time of year where God is giving a special ability now to do just this, a time to look at all the different pieces that make up a body with the good eye to bring balance. Again, it's a month to balance our vision. We're trying to see the spark of God within everyone and everything now. So this doesn't only apply to religious people. It's not just a body of Yeshua that we are looking at in this way. We need to be training ourselves to always be able to see anyone we encounter throughout the day on multiple levels. On the one hand, we can have our guard up and see what might be dangerous or just, you know, off. We need to be able to see with this eye. But on the other hand, we need to be able to see that same person in front of us with a more generous eye, one that sees their outward form and can intuit from that some clues to what is good and right and true within that person. There's a somewhat strange-seeming verse from Parsha Shemot in chapter 2. So Exodus 2:25 reads like this, "And God saw the sons of Israel, and God knew them." So this is a verse about God seeing the children of Israel in their slavery when they call out to him in Egypt. And this seeing leads to him knowing them. Well, what did he see? Did he just look down and see an enslaved people neck deep in the impurity of Egypt? A stiff-necked people, as they would later be called? Clearly, he saw them, well, I'm sure he saw that, but he also saw them in a different way. He looked past their bitterness and infighting and idolatry, and he saw a treasure. He knew them. He knew who they really were. He looked past the Egyptian clothing and saw what they could be because of what they really are inside, because he knows what he put inside them. He saw that Israel could be his treasured people. So let me tell a quick story here of something that impacted me years ago when I was in a store and I was just shopping for my different things, and there was someone walking by who was arguing with their parent, and I'm in the next aisle and someone has this just multicolored hair and all these piercings, I mean, and just one person after the next, just, I was having such a negative reaction to all the people around me, and I was thinking, what's going on with this planet? What's going on with our culture? And I was just spiraling into just the negativity, and I caught myself, and I stopped, and I thought, you know what, God loves each of these people as much as he loves me. And what I'm going to do is, as I walk down these aisles, I'm going to see something good in each of these people. And so here comes someone, lots of tattoos, whatever. And I'm thinking, no, that's a person who's creative. There's a creativity in that person. And, you know, I'm seeing someone else who, you know, they're arguing because they have a strong sense of justice. You know, it's not just papering over. I think it's true. And so can I just say that that grocery store changed? It wasn't the same grocery store. I was not in the same place. And it lifted my spirits. And if I were to interact with any of those people on that day, the second me in the second grocery store is going to interact with people in a much different way than that first person. So can I just say that people can sense it when we are seeing them with only the left eye, or when we are seeing them more fully with both eyes? You don't even have to say anything. We just enter a room and our spirit is affecting the room immediately. Grant would often remind us that it's easy to see where one body ends and another begins, but it's not so easy when it comes to the spirit. What if our spirits are extending beyond these bodies? What if our spirits can actually overlap, right, in the room? And what if our spirits can communicate with each other as they overlap? we might be a little dull in understanding what other spirits are saying, but would it be surprising if a little communication, you know, does get through to the person? Somehow people can sense it. They can sense it. So when we interact with someone from a place of negativity and people feel that, and they will react to us, and it's like a cascading thing that happens. And when we interact with someone really seeing them, really seeing who they are, seeing their faults, but not letting their faults stop us from seeing something deeper in them, of course they can sense that too. And people are drawn to those who can really see the good in them. So let me give now one of the most important points related to this idea of seeing with the good, you know, good eye over the bad eye, right? When you see someone's pure inner spark, and when you tell them what you see, when you put it into words, you help that person know his or her deeper identity, right? We can't always see our gifts ourselves. We need the body to help us recognize and become who we truly are. Like, how many people talk about one teacher who said this positive thing to them and it shaped the rest of their lives because they saw themselves differently from that point on? Your eye helps you to know who, your eye helps me to know who I am and who I'm made to be. And by God's design, we're a little bit blind, right? I'm a little bit blind to myself. So a connected point here, since we are designed to help each other see ourselves, when we do that, we are becoming who we are supposed to be. We are acting according to our design when we see and speak this way, right? We are all designed to be flashlights that see into other souls and help to bring out the good there. Right? Being a torch is part of the identity of all people. And another thing that is also extremely important in this discussion, when we are gracious enough to see past someone's faults and help to bring their good qualities to the surface, we are being like God, acting according to the image of God. So how is that? Does not God look down on us and see our faults and every misstep? Yet he sees the good he put in us. He sees his own image in us, and he speaks that to us. So how does he speak that to us? Well, he does so in many ways, the most important being the Torah, which is like a mirror, right? It's a mirror to us. But his design is also to use other people, to use your spouse, to use your workmates. And there are also many people who can look into nature and even see qualities in themselves there, good qualities. So this seeing ourselves through nature is a growing aspect of our modern age that can be easily corrupted, right? Kind of a nature worship. But the root there is actually a good root. So not only are we being like God when we extend this kind of grace to others, but God draws near to us when we see and speak with the good eye. God draws near to us. You want to walk closer with God? Be that person with a ready smile and a keen and mature eye that is able to look past the coarse outer shell of the flesh and be used as a vessel to uncover and unmask the goodness in others. It's not easy. It's a constant challenge because it takes more effort to see past the surface. But this is the way of maturity. It is the way, right? And I think in our politics and our red versus blue, we would do well to take advantage of the month of Tevet to spend some time seeing what is good in everyone around us. So, of course, there is always a balance. We need to be wise and to not put ourselves in danger or our families or our communities in danger. So this requires wisdom. So let me quickly make a connection to the Haftorah here, which is from Isaiah 27 and 28. There are a couple of mysterious verses here that bring in another dimension to the idea of seeing with the good eye. The passage is describing the redemption of Israel. God is going to smash their enemies and bring them back from the four corners of the earth. And in Isaiah 27, and in verses 6 to 7, the NASB reads, "In the days to come, Jacob will take root. Israel will blossom and sprout, and they will fill the whole world with fruit. Like the striking of him who has struck them, has he struck them? Or like the slaughter of his slain, have they been slain?" Okay, it's a really strange, it's a strange verse, to say the least, and the translations vary. But I think that what's important is to recognize that God is promising to bring them through, and when it's all over, there will be these questions in their mind. Did he strike us at all? You know, we thought he struck us, but did he actually strike us? Were we even slain at all? We thought we were dead, but was that what he was doing? In other words, they're going to look back at their captivity and see it through different eyes, with the good eye. And they're going to say, was that God striking us? Or was that God bringing us back to life, right? Was that God slaying us? Or was he resurrecting us? In other words, Isaiah is saying, you're going to look back into the past and see that God was working everything for good, right? Those famous words that Joseph said, God was doing it for good. So can I challenge us to do this even today? Look back at the strikings and the slayings and captivities in your life and try to see them with the good eye, right? There's a lot of healing that comes with going back into the past and saying, God meant it for good. God meant it for good, and it is good, and it has been good. So let's move to a different topic here. We're on the 19th of Tevet today, and we came through a minor holiday, a minor fast called the 10th of Tevet. The 10th of Tevet fits right into the emphasis of the month, as it must. And so just to quickly explain the 10th of Tevet, it is a morning of the day when Jerusalem was surrounded by the Babylonian army. This is the siege, the beginning of the siege of Jerusalem, which ends in the taking of Jerusalem, the destruction, the burning of the temple, and the captivity of Israel. So it's a half day of, well, it's a day of mourning from sunrise to sunset on the 10th of Tevet. And at its heart is the opportunity to see the goodness in other people, right? That seems like a strange thing to say, a fast for the destruction of the temple, basically, is an opportunity to see the goodness in other people. Well, let me tell you why. Each of the fast days in the year is both seen as an opportunity to mourn the destruction of the temples. The four special fast days are all involving the destruction of the temples and the captivity. So they're seen as times to mourn the destruction of the temples, but also as an opportunity to correct the evil that led to the destruction of the temples. So on the one hand, we can mourn the loss of the connection to God, which is the temple. But on the other hand, we can work on bringing correction to those areas that caused the destruction. So the rabbis, I have heard talk about this, bring both temples into the picture. They're destroyed on the same day in the calendar on the 9th of Av. And so they look at this 10th of Tevet as a beginning point for that destruction process for both the temples. And where they seem to end up focusing on is what caused the destruction of the second temple. Because I think they sense that they still have work to do in that area. And so what do they say caused the second temple's destruction? sinat kinam, baseless hatred. Of course, we know that this baseless hatred was directed against Yeshua, right? The Second Temple was destroyed in 70 AD, so 70 years. Well, not even 70 years after the death of Yeshua. And Yeshua actually says this, that they hated me without a cause. He says this in John chapter 15. But their hatred wasn't limited to Yeshua. The Israel of Yeshua's time was filled with factional infighting between such groups as the Sadducees and the Pharisees. So here's the point. If baseless hatred is what caused the destruction of the Second Temple, and if we focus on rectifying on these fast days related to the temple's destruction, then we are to focus on what? The rectification, baseless love, right? Which is basically the Christian definition for grace, right? Grace is, you know, baseless love. It's love without a cause, you know, you could say. So in other words, these fast days, including the 10th of Tevet, are seen as days to extend grace to each other, to see each other with the good eye. And isn't grace at the heart of seeing the good in others? All right, so that's the month of Tevet. Kind of a lot, but let's go ahead now and take a little bit more of a look at the first Torah portion of Vayechi. We've been pointing out that our focus has now shifted from the inside to the outside, from the primarily soulish work to a work that is more focused on the body and the vast world beyond the body. And in our discussion of the month of Tevet, we made that body focus a bit more specific in explaining how it is that we are now learning to see the body with both a critical eye and a generous eye. So as we turn to Parsha Vayechi, let's see if we can go even one step further. We can see a clear connection to this idea of seeing the body with both eyes in Jacob's blessing of who? Who is he blessing? He's blessing the 12 tribes. So obviously, since the tribes are receiving a kind of evaluation here from their father Jacob, we can easily see that the connection to seeing the body with both eyes. We can see that Jacob is seeing his sons in a clear, open-eyed way, as some of the blessings are very positive and some are negative. Jacob is seeing them with both of his eyes, and Jacob shows us the further step we're looking for, too, because he doesn't just see. What is his action? I think we have to describe the action Jacob takes with the word pruning. Pruning. Rather than go into detail for each blessing, you know, we just have time now to take kind of the 30,000-foot view, but we'll make a point here to see what it is that his action is that helps further our discussion here. So as we begin thinking about Jacob's blessings, let's keep a few points in mind. The name of the portion Vayechi means, and he lived, and Jacob lived. He lived for 17 years in Egypt. Therefore, though this portion records Jacob's death, we have to assume that what we're seeing here is the key to life for his family. All right? This is a portion about life. So whatever Jacob is saying to the 12 tribes, it is meant for life. Secondly, let's remember that Jacob is a father, and these are his sons, who he loves. These are not just sons, they are expressions of Jacob himself. When he sees Reuben, he's seeing an aspect of himself. Jacob can see his sons clearly in a balanced way with both eyes. He has much praise to give, but he also rebukes some of his sons. So Jacob understands the power of the father's blessing to affect the future. And this is something else we need to keep in mind. He understands the power of this moment and of this blessing to affect the future. He's going to do what it takes to help ensure Israel's flourishing no matter how difficult. So what do these points add up to? They add up to this. Jacob is not just predicting the future. He's using the power of his blessing to shape the future of Israel. He's shaping Israel. Jacob's blessings are a pruning of the branches of Israel. The 12 tribes are the branches. Pruning is difficult, but it is what is necessary for fruitfulness. Jacob is pruning his family. So how is he doing that? Jacob can see which branches need to be encouraged to grow big and strong within Israel, which tribes need to become leaders, which will produce good fruit, which are situated to receive the best light, and which branches need to be limited, reduced, so that they don't take up too much space and energy within the body. Limitation is the essence of curse. So what we're seeing here is really the affecting of blessings and curses affected by Jacob's spoken words in his last moments of life. It's not an easy thing for a father to do, especially in one's dying moments. Your inclination would be to just say nice things and give blessings that all of them would grow equally and prosper. What Jacob does instead is to risk hurting and even humiliating some of them for the sake of the survival and prosperity of the whole body. It's a gripping and fraught and beautiful thing he's doing, a brave act, a powerful act, and ultimately a very selfless act. He puts his enduring reputation among the tribes aside, and he does what he needs to do. He's saying, this is not about my ego in this moment. This is not about my reputation in this moment. It's such an amazing passage that speaks to the greatness of the patriarchs and the matriarchs. Parsha Vayechi has something to add here to the discussion of the month of Tevet. We aren't just seeing the parts of the body with both eyes. We're also being empowered now to act based upon that vision, to cut away that which is not fruitful in our lives. So obviously we're not going around in public in the grocery store and cutting those branches, but we can look inwardly at our own body right now, our own lives. He's giving us special vision to do that, to see ourselves more clearly. Why? So that we can cut away that which needs to be cut away, like Jacob does here. Jacob is literally pruning the branches of his own body, the 12 sons who will make up the nation of Israel moving forward. So the counterpart to this deep winter pruning in the year, by the way, is the pruning of the grapevines in the deep summer. So there's always an opposite reflection across the calendar. Directly opposite us now is the pruning of the grapevines in the summer. So let's keep this idea that Jacob is here pruning the family in mind, because we're coming close already to the month of Shavat. And Shavat means both tribe and branch. It's the month that contains the new year for trees, called Tu B'Shvat. Tu B'Shvat. Anyway, so just put that in the back of your mind. A final word here about life and death. This portion named for life contains two deaths, and not just two deaths, but the deaths of two of the greatest figures in the whole of the Torah, Jacob and Joseph. In truth, the Parsha seems much more focused on death than life. And guess what the focus of the Haftorah is? It's the death of none other than King David. So in other words, during the week of the portion named "And He Lived," we're reading about the deaths of three of the most important figures in the entire Bible, Jacob, Joseph, and David. There's a paradox here that is another mark of the season. It's a paradox that will increase in this part of the year. Paradox itself, paradox, is a primary feature of Purim, the next mile marker for us in the year, right? What looked like it was death for Israel turned out to be life, this turning on its head is an important part of Purim, and that's the next moed we're headed toward. So we're seeing paradox increasing in the year. The sages say that as we draw closer and closer to God, we draw closer to paradox, because there's something very paradoxical at the heart of God. This is why we, when we see God represented kind of in a physical picture form in the Word, we often see fire mixed with water, these two opposite elements combined in a strangely supernatural kind of echad. You know, it might be lake mixed with fire, something like that, or lightning running through it. What is at the root of this paradox? And maybe, you know, of course, we'll be learning about that for the rest of our lives, really, but maybe the root of it is something like this. You don't get new life until you surrender the old life. You're not really alive unless you're constantly dying. Dying is the key to growing with Him, growing near to Him, and doing that which we are made to do here on this planet. Dying is the key to being a living sacrifice. Do you hear the paradox in the phrase living sacrifice? Rather than constantly resisting death, right? This world out there wants you to do everything you can to not die, right? Rather than that focus, we should be waking up each morning and saying to God, bring it on. You know, I kind of hesitate to say that, you know, wake up and bring it on, God. You have to think twice before you do that. But I think that's what we need to do when we wake up in the morning. Bring it, right? Lead us into the right ways to die for you today. We need to embrace death and not fear it, because it's the key to true life. So I'm not talking about actual death here, though if I'm called to that for some extreme reason, right? If the gun is to my head, I pray that I will be strong and submit to it, right? Rather than denying God, for example, or Yeshua. I'm not really talking about that, though. I'm mostly talking about the life of self-sacrificial service. The foundation of the universe is one act, Yeshua's death and resurrection. This is the foundational act, and it echoes throughout time and space. It is the very shape of time and space. Yeshua's death and resurrection is the air we breathe and the water we drink. Death and life are so closely linked together in this universe that they are inseparable. It's one of the enemy's greatest lies that death is to be feared. The right kind of death, death for the sake of God and others, is to be embraced as the root of all life. Okay, well, that was a little bit heavy, but let's go ahead and turn to Parsha Shemot now. The first portion in the book of Exodus, and the Parsha for which the whole book is named, right? The whole book is named Shemot. The book of Shemot will be our companion from now to the end of Adar, right? The last month of the year. When we come to the end of Exodus, we come to the very last week of the year. The first portion of Leviticus, which is the next book, right? Vayikra, coincides with the first week of Nisan, right? So right as we're changing to the beginning of the new year, we're starting the book of Leviticus in the spring. So my main question here is this, and what the question to frame this discussion of Parsha Shemot is this: what does the book of Shemot have to do with this quadrant of the year, these 3 months? Why are we reading the story of the Exodus, the story of the redemption now? What does that have to do with the end of this salvation journey? So to begin answering this question, let's start by looking at the meaning of the word Shemot. Shemot means names. The book begins with the names of the children of Israel who descend to Egypt in the final years of Jacob's life. So what does names have to do with anything? As we have learned many times, your name is a description of your essence. It is both your true self and your mission in this world. So hear this point. What does it mean that we are reading the book of Essence in the last 3 months of the year? It means that we are making that final drive to expressing our true essence. We're in the home stretch, and the result will be the kind of shalom that is the vehicle for us to express exactly who we are created to be. So we get a picture of that shalom at the end of the book of Shemot in those glorious chapters. I don't know why, but they've always been some of my favorite chapters in the whole of the Torah, when the people of Israel are working with one heart to construct a beautiful home for God, the tabernacle, a dwelling place for God on earth. And God comes and lives among them in a special way. I just always love those chapters. They're full of all these details. I love details, which is another aspect of the end of the year, all this physical detail. So the next logical question is, if we are making that final drive toward expressing our name, what is our name? What is our essence? So obviously, we each have our individual names. And so we are now in this winter season being empowered to better express our individuality for the sake of the kingdom. But beyond that, individual name are names that we have in common that describe a common essence, right? So for the genetic descendants of Jacob, one of these names is Jew, right? Where does this name come from, this name Jew? I bring it up because it's a direct connection to our last teaching about Joseph and Judah. The name Jew comes from Yehuda, Judah, right? The whole people end up being called by the name of the tribe of Judah. And to this day, I hear Jews call each other a Yid or a Yid. When a Yid does this, when a Yid does that. That's the way I hear them talk about each other a lot, right? Which is a connection to Judah, Yehuda. The construction of the Torah portions here, it's just one of those mind-blowing examples. It's breathtaking. It's the breathtaking poetry that only God can design. The Torah portion that begins the winter season, Vayigash, begins with the moment when Judah, one of the 12, steps up to fulfill his essence as he draws near to Joseph and says, "Let Benjamin go, take me instead." So Judah is fulfilling his essence in the first paragraph of the winter, the season in which we are all driving toward expressing our essence. Those words that Judah speaks to Joseph are a kind of seed for the season of the winter. It's just amazing the way God designs these things. But whereas Jew refers specifically to the descendants of Jacob, there's an even broader name that includes even we who are grafted in, the name Israel. Gentiles are not called Jews, right? We who are grafted in are called by the name Israel, which is a description of a common essence for all of us in both of God's flocks. It seems to be a strange description of essence, but there's a profound truth here that should be encouraging and comforting to us. So, as we have learned many times, Israel means one who struggles with God. The context of the giving of this name adds two important ideas. It's not just struggling with God. The angel says to Jacob, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." Okay? And so that's in Genesis 32. So it's not just us struggling with God, but also with man. And it's not just a struggle, but it's also a winning, okay? It's a struggling and a prevailing with both God and man. So that's a description of the essence of both of God's flocks, Jew and Gentile. So what is encouraging, though, about this name Israel? So to answer that, let me read from an article about the name Israel, written by Rabbi Aaron Moss. And this is what he says. He said, here is the essence of Judaism. We do believe that goodness prevails, but the happy ending is not our focus. Our focus is the struggle to get there. Regardless of the result, the struggle itself is holy. If you strive for goodness, you're in, even before you get there. If you're trying to be better, even if you fall sometimes, you're on the path. It's all about the struggle. And he continues, that's why the Torah doesn't speak about heaven. We believe in the afterlife, but we aren't preoccupied with it. We focus our energy on the effort to be a good person, the struggle to do the right thing, the battle against our adversaries, both internal and external. Some religion seeks serenity, he says Rabbi Aaron. Some spiritual paths promise peace. Others offer a place in heaven. Judaism embraces the struggle of the here and now. The victory will come, but for the time being, we are here to grapple with God, debate with our fellow humans, and struggle with ourselves, never accepting that the world can't change, starting with me. That's Israel. So again, to repeat what Rabbi Moss is saying, the name Israel, which we can say is a description of both Jew and Gentile grafted in, means that our essence is not tied to reaching a certain point, a certain goal, which brings a kind of pressure of, what if I don't get there? That kind of end goal is not our essence, at least for now. What is a better description of our essence is anyone who gets in the game, right? Get in the game. That makes you Israel, right? We just have to keep walking with him, contending with him, and by his grace, winning bit by bit. And this is why the Bible isn't particularly concerned with giving us a vivid description of heaven. A vivid description of heaven would only be a distraction from our essential mission here on earth, which is much more about the journey than anything else. So we should expect that the book of Exodus is going to help us this year learn to express even better our essence, both our essence as Israel and our personal name as well. In future lessons, we'll have more time to talk about these ideas and the fascinating pictures God is giving us through Egypt and the Exodus process. For now, let's just take away from this introduction to the book of Exodus the idea that we are making a final movement toward expressing our core self, at least for this cycle. Let's apply some of today's discussion now directly to Yeshua. We've already talked about how paradox grows in this season and how Yeshua is the ultimate example of that kind of paradox we're talking about. Lay down your life for God's sake, and he will give it back to you, only better. Lower yourself down, and he will raise you up in the same way that Yeshua gave his life and then was raised up by God, not only by means of resurrection, but also in being placed at God's right hand and being given a name that is above every other name, that at the name of Yeshua, every knee will bow and every tongue confess that Yeshua the Messiah is Lord to the glory of God the Father. But let me speak now to, so paradox, we can definitely see that in Yeshua. Let me speak to another idea related to Yeshua. In terms of being able to see with both eyes in a balanced way, then act on that vision in a brave way, who is better than Yeshua? Yeshua certainly didn't see with rose-colored glasses, handing out praise and flattery wherever he went, nor did he only rebuke, but he knew how to praise and comfort when each was needed, and he knew how to discipline and rebuke when that was necessary. He could look at the little children and see their great value and invite them to draw near to him. He could look at Zacchaeus and see the good struggle happening inside of him and act on that vision to affirm him and bring salvation. He could see clearly when someone's faith was strong enough to open the doorway to healing and heal them, right? He could see, he could tell, well, that person has enough faith to be healed. And he could see the corruption in the leadership of the time and speak against it bravely, right? He knew they wanted to kill him eventually. And I think perhaps the biggest example of Yeshua's ability to see past the flesh and into the soul and spirit is his choice of apostles. What did others see in the apostles? Fishermen, a tax collector. One is called a zealot, which is a political revolutionary. These were backwater bumpkins, right, who were passed over by other rabbis, not chosen, not seen. But how did he call Nathanael? He saw him standing under the fig tree, and he knew that he was an Israelite in whom there was no deceit. These were common men who mostly worked with their hands, so common that God doesn't even tell us what many of them did for a living. It's not really important. What's important is what's inside, which Yeshua can see. He could see much more deeply, and he bravely acted on that balanced vision. He deeply invested in these men. He told them to leave their trades and to follow him. He spent hour after hour with them. So he not only saw, but he acted on what he saw, like Jacob does in giving his powerful but also painful blessings, the pruning of Israel. Lastly here, let's make the point that Yeshua was fond of gardening and farming metaphors, including the important idea of pruning. So let me close this section about Yeshua with several verses of Yeshua's own words from John 15, which we may be able to spend some more time on later. It's a section where Yeshua mentions several times the sending of the Holy Spirit. And he says this, "I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, that it may bear more fruit. Already you are clean because of the word that I have spoken to you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me." Okay, so he's talking about this whole agricultural metaphor here. And Yeshua is saying that life comes by pruning. So some branches have to be completely cut away, while others can be kept, but they still require pruning, right? If we stay in him by keeping his commandments, we won't be cut away completely, but we will be pruned, and that will be for our good, so that we can be fruitful. We can't escape that pruning, nor should we want to. Death is the doorway to life. So lastly, let's turn to Joshua chapter 6 here, which is the fall of Jericho. So let's make a quick connection to Joshua, to Jericho and what's happening here in chapter 6. And what I want to do is hone in on God's command to Israel to use shofars, as they do, with these men of war marching around for days as escorts for the priests blowing shofars. God doesn't do anything without each detail being deeply meaningful. We need to ask why he is directing Israel's fighting men to play second fiddle, as it were, to the priests with the ram's horns walking in front of the ark. In the end, it is the people acting like trumpets, shouting, right? We're shouting. We ourselves are acting like a trumpet. We do that. That's what really brings the walls down in the end. Although they're undermined, we can say, for days by the priest blowing the trumpets. So what is going on here, right? Why is God not emphasizing the military guys with their swords, but he is emphasizing the trumpets and the shouting? The shofar is a vessel for breath and wind. In Hebrew, the words breath, wind, and spirit are all the same, ruach. We can easily say then that the trumpet is a vessel for the flowing of the spirit, the ruach. What God is telling Israel to do is to bring down the vast walls of this ancient city, not by the power of their arms and swords, but with their breath, by the power of the spirit. It brings to mind the famous passage from Zechariah, "Not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts." This first battle sets the stage for all the battles to come in the land. What is God saying here? He's saying that they don't defeat the Canaanites by their own might, but by his spirit working through them. Let's take from this today the encouragement that as we enter into these last days, we will be victorious because his spirit is in us. The challenge to see in balance and then act bravely like Jacob did, like Yeshua did, in such an egoless way, that's no small thing. Learning to express our name, our essence, is not an easy process. It's like battle. Submitting to the snipping off of our own branches that are not producing fruit, it's tough, but we have his spirit in us. And by the power of his spirit, those walls against fruitfulness will come down, just as they did at Jericho. The shofar is really a remarkably rich symbol, and it's one that deserves some meditation. So let's remember that on both of the altars that God designs, the big altar in the outer court and the golden altar of incense, there are four horns at the four corners. Clearly, this is a central image for us that is rich with meaning, right? God uses horns in special ways, right? We need to think about that. So in that vein, I have one last point here about the shofar, and it's a point that follows from the discussion of death as the doorway to life. Because I think this important biblical symbol, the shofar, has within it the message that our true usefulness and power in this world only comes after we are put to death. So let me repeat that in different words. In the shofar, we can see that it is in surrender and death that we achieve our highest purpose here. So the horn is a symbol of strength. It is tough, and unlike antlers that are shed each year, the horn, right, horn and antler, they're not the same thing. The horn is made of living bone surrounded by a hard outer keratin covering. So again, horns are living tissue inside, which is different from antlers, and horns continue growing throughout the animal's lifetime. If we could maybe transpose a bit of human sensibility onto the animals. An animal's horns are a great source of pride. They can be used to attract a mate or to defend a harem or just to say, look at me and my giant horns, right? So they're kind of a source of pride. Thinking about this idea of the horns being a source of one's own strength and pride, recall that at the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, the ram is caught in a thicket by its horns. So each of these details is important. It is the ram's horns, its source of self-pride and self-strength, that impede its progress on the earth. It gets stuck because of its pride. And this becomes a greater and greater danger for the animal, the larger those horns grow. Now think about what has to happen for that horn to become a shofar, the instrument that announces great events in world history, the instrument that is also worthy to hold the oil with which priests and kings are anointed. It's an exalted vessel, this horn, right? It's an important thing. But what does it have to go through in order to be used in these ways? The animal has to be put to death, and the stony life that was in it, that living bone, has to be emptied out. It's only then that in the hands of the shepherd, the shofar is capable of serving in these exalted ways. It's a breathtaking picture, really. I think one lesson we can learn from the shofar is that whatever we take great pride in is a kind of snare for us in life. But if we submit to death, God can take that source of pride, hollow it out, and blow his spirit through it, or fill it with the oil of his spirit, using it as a vessel. There's great power in the sound of the shofar. It travels far and pierces us and stirs up something deep within us. And again, it's there when the priests, you know, the shofar is there, when the priests and the kings are elevated to their positions. So the choice to place the shofar here at the center of the action in Joshua 6 says to Israel, death is the doorway to the flow of the Spirit of God through you. And in that flow is the real power to defeat your enemies, regardless of how solid and high their walls are. Put to death that pride in whatever talent that is, and surrender that talent to him. Allow him to hollow it out for his purposes, and then use it in this world. So Yeshua has much to say about sending the Spirit to us and the Spirit working through us. When he removes himself from earth, he sends the Spirit. And so, like I said before, I suspect that we are heading now into a portion of the calendar where the voice of the Spirit is increasing for us. So let's be listening for the sound of the shofar in these days. We know that the shofar has a role at the end of days, and the end of the calendar each year teaches us about the end of days. And let's be listening for the voice of the Spirit in our lives now. So I'll make one last point here today. It's thought that the name Jericho actually comes from the word Ruach, the name for spirit, the word for spirit that we've been talking about. And there are a couple ideas. One also is moon. That word is a possible origin for the name Jericho. Both of them have meanings that work together. But using the one Ruach for spirit for Jericho, Israel is attacking a spiritual enemy with a spiritual weapon. So this is a reminder to us that our battle in the end, no matter how physical it looks, is a spiritual battle. I'm saying that we're at a time where we're focusing less on the inside and more on the outside. But here with Jericho, God is saying, yes, it's going to look more on the outside. Our attentions, our energies are being put more on the outside. But don't be confused by that, right? It is all, in the end, a spiritual battle. So don't be fooled. The physical will follow along with the spiritual progress, but it's the spiritual progress that is the mover and the important thing. So that's all for today. Thank you so much for listening. I find it remarkable that anyone is listening to these, but more power to you. Lord bless you, and to him be the glory. So may we be people of balanced vision who are brave to act upon what we see. And may he make us into the people he wants us to be. Shalom.